Good morning, everyone. So today we're going to finish up talking about the initial data problem in GR and give an example of solving the conformal transverse traceless equations. And then we'll move on to talking about how to define black hole horizons in dynamical settings. So last lecture, we talked about how to start with Hamiltonian momentum constraints and put them into this form of the conformal transverse traceless equations. So just to review this here, so just rewritten the equations. So who can tell me what the free data is in these equations, which functions we would freely specify? Anybody? Lots of right answers. What is the free data for these equations? So let's just to recall, we started. You know, our problem was we need to choose a three-metric and extrinsic curvature that satisfy the Hamiltonian constraints. So that means we have how many degrees of freedom originally for 12. 12, yeah. So two 3 by 3 symmetric tensors. So that'd be 6 each, so 12.
Have a bit less stuff.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, so just it'd be they each have 9 components, but they're symmetric, so they only 6 of them are unique. And then for the Hamiltonian momentum equations, how many constraints does that give us in terms of scalar degrees of freedom? That gives us 4. So that means we need to specify 8 degrees of freedom. So let's just go back and make sure everything works out here. So what is the free data here?
You have psi. You
have A. So yeah, A this one is one. Aij transverse traceless.
Why not psi? Psi is also the scalar, isn't it?
Yeah, so that's going to be one of our constrained data. So the point is, we have some of these equations we freely specify, and then the remaining ones we'd solve these equations for. And so, you know, as we worked out last time, basically these form nice elliptic equations for psi, and then what's this one for? So the other constrained data would be this xi. So that's our constrained data we solve for. And then to recap, what's the other free data we have? Yeah, k is one of them. Trace of the extrinsic curvature.
Pi is also something that.
Yeah, so that in addition, we have these matter fields. So those are also free data, but I guess we didn't put them here, so we'll just not include them as well. Well, so R is computed from something, but do you remember what the real free data is?
Still, yeah, it's kind of. Gamma tilts.
Yeah, so the conformal metric. And I think that's it. And then plus the matter.
If psi is constrained, how come gamma is not, or gamma tilde is just like either there was psi or something times gamma, right? We already say that, you know, gamma ij is like one of the constraints, and then fit, you would also call it that psi is the constraint and constraining. And then you were saying that gamma tilde is not.
Yeah, so that's free data, so we specify whatever we want. But now I think maybe where we're going is let's count the degrees of freedom here and make sure we have the right number. So how many degrees of freedom should gamma tilde have?
Should still be six, or but it's because it's traceless. The determiner is one, right?
Right, well, so we didn't require it to be one, but yeah, if you... Basically, if you multiply it by something, then you'll just get, like, if you have a solution for some gamma tilde, right, then and you solve for psi, then you have sort of the same physical solution if you multiply your gamma tilde by an arbitrary constant and divide your psi by that, you know, with the fourth root. So yeah, so in essence, this has how many degrees of freedom in terms of, like, physical space. Yeah, so we have five here. And then how many here?
It should be one.
Right? Yep, that's one. And then how about this one?
Two? Is it three or two?
Yeah, so it's two. So
two.
Yeah. We started with the extrinsic curvature here, and like as you recall, basically this is the decomposition we did. We took out the trace, so it was over six. We took out the trace, and then we took out the transverse part. So that's basically one vector degree of freedom, right? So that's 3 degrees of freedom. And then the remaining part. So that should be 6 minus 1 minus 3. So 2 left. Yeah. So then we did our addition right. We have 8 free data, 4 constrained data, and it adds up to this.
For gamma ij there, and then why are we subtracting things from this? Over there you were mentioning that gij has like 2 degrees of freedom, and then you were mentioning that gamma ij has 6, and then we're subtracting from the rest. Why we're subtracting something there?
So these two are by construction traceless, right? So they don't have, so they're symmetric and traceless, so they as a whole, you just have 5 degrees of freedom here, right? And then you've, in addition, taken those 5 degrees of freedom and put the transverse part here and the non-transverse part here.
Okay. And then we'll reduce it to 2?
So we have 2 here, 3 here. And then one more here. We started with 6, and this is how we divided up the different degrees of freedom.
Oh, I see.
Sorry, what are you saying? Gamma ij doesn't have any degrees of freedom in this case? You're saying k is 1.
So, there's 6 degrees of freedom here, and we've divided it up into 1 here,
yeah, and then
3 here, and 2 there. Yeah.
Then what is gamma ij then?
This is so maybe we can rewrite that in terms of, you know, psi 4. That's just the 3 metric. Because I took out the trace part, right?
But here we took into account
Yeah, yeah, I mean, so like in general.
Is gamma tilde exactly the same as sigma tilde?
This gamma tilde is the 3 metric, and gamma tilde is the conformal metric, and they're related by side of the 4.
If that has 5 degrees of freedom, then why aren't you saying?
Well, we already. So I mean, in general, to fully construct the extrinsic curvature, yeah, you need the conform. You also need the conformal factors and the conformal metric from this. But we already included those here and here, so we don't want to double count them, right?
No, but if you did include them and you still said Kij has 6 degrees of freedom, then you would say, oh, this doesn't make any sense because that one has 6 and everything else has a bunch of other degrees of freedom. Because you know Kij has 6 degrees of freedom.
Right, yeah.
And let's say you erase that gamma tilde ij from there and you want to take into account take that into account in here. But that thing itself has 6. I'm sorry, 5. The gamma tilde has 5.
Given these variables, given all these variables, I can completely reconstruct Kij and gamma ij, right? That's what I'm saying. So, we shouldn't double count them here, right? So.
Okay.
And we could go either way you want, but yeah.
Okay, makes sense. Sorry, what is the minus 1 you put there? What is it?
This is plus.
Ah.
So we equal 8. Yep.
So we in general, we just have 12 degrees of freedom. And 8 of them are free data, and the rest are constraints.
Yeah.
Remember? And the constraints are that psi, xi, so these are the 4, right?
Yeah, so the idea is, in the beginning, we just know we have to come up with these that satisfy the constraint equations. So we want to do, but we have to specify some part. So here we sort of worked out how to do that so that we can ideally choose these freely based on what the physical system we're interested in. So we'll say a little bit more about that in a second. And then we want to be able to choose these freely, but we want to be able to sort of solve some nice PDEs that will guarantee us the solution if we solve them. And so we put it in this form. So now we can just solve these PDEs and get out what, these elliptic PDEs and get out what psi and x is. And then those will guarantee that we satisfy the constraint equations with that free data.
Maybe the reason I was confused was I thought gamma ij and kij that you wrote over there is also constrained, but yeah, if they're not constrained and just...
Yeah, the idea is that once you solve for these and then you construct kij this way and you construct gamma ij this way, then these will be guaranteed to solve the constraint equations in the original form.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions about that? So first, let's do the simplest example we could have. So we'll choose vacuum free data. So that's just setting all the matter terms to 0. We're going to choose maximal slicing and the waveless approximation. So as we'll talk a little bit more about next week, in some sense we can think of this transverse trace degrees of freedom as the gravitational wave degrees of freedom, approximately. So we can call setting those to 0 a waveless approximation. And then we can choose our metric to be conformally flat. And just set the conformal metric be the flat metric. And then Since these are elliptic equations, we need to specify boundary conditions. So sort of the simplest ones would be to let the conformal factor go to 1 at infinity. So then we'll just, you know, get an asymptotically flat metric. And to also let this... I'm saying that at infinity, so the bound. So this is an elliptic problem, so we need to specify boundary conditions for. So my boundary condition is going to be that psi goes to 1 at r equals infinity.
Why 1?
That way we'll get an asymptotically flat space time because we'll have the flat metric at infinity. Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to let this go to 0 for the same reason. So with these simplifications, our equations are the following. So if I just let my domain be, you know, R3, then, I mean, it's pretty obvious what the solution is going to be, right?
So where did that come from? That equation, where did it come from?
This is basically just taking these equations and then plugging in these simplifications.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so... if the domain is all of R3, then what's the solution just by inspection? Yeah, that's a question. What is the solution?
Okay.
Class.
The second one is with the Laplace equation.
The first one is also delta Lx is the same as like the derivative of x, right?
It's this like conformal Lie derivative, right? Yeah. Yeah, maybe we can think about xi first. So if it's 0 to infinity, can we solve this equation?
It would be 0 everywhere.
0 everywhere, okay. And then if this is, then we can ignore this term, that's 0 everywhere. So then if psi is 1 to infinity, what's the solution? Yeah, so then we just get flat space everywhere. So that's a little too simple an example. So. We need a slightly different domain to get some non-trivial solution. So what we're going to do is consider our domain to be R3, but with a ball taken out of the center of radius R. And so basically, we're going to specify some boundary conditions at this ball at the origin of radius r to get some non-trivial solution. So what we're going to do is require that that the unit normal has divergence 0. So that's this, which is the same as requiring that the mean curvature vanish on this ball. So in terms of the conformal metric, that's this. And then if we just write it in terms of these radial coordinates, we get. So then with these inner boundary conditions and these outer boundary conditions, sort of, again, by inspection, you can check, or well, here, we can rewrite this out a little bit. So we have and psi goes to 1, r goes to infinity. And so again, with these boundary conditions, just by inspection, what's the solution for xi?
Sorry, what was s again?
S is the unit normal on this ball. So it's basically just points in the radial direction. So basically, this just reduces to some non-trivial boundary condition for psi. But then, again, we can just let xi be 0. And so then this one is unchanged again, right? So again, we're going to just get xi equals 0. But then we'll have something non-trivial here. So we just want to solve basically the Laplace equation. With this inner boundary condition and this outer boundary condition and this inner boundary condition. So you can check that the unique solution is just going to be psi equals 1 plus, this is the r, the radius of the ball, over our radial coordinate r. And then if we, you know, write out the metric that we get, it actually turns out to just be a slice of Schwarzschild in isotropic coordinates. And here, this m is equal to 2r, and that actually turns out to be the mass of the black hole. Yep.
I don't quite get the boundary condition whether we're saying that at r equal to a fixed constant radius,
yep,
capital R, I'm having the partial derivative of psi with respect to r equal to something. Isn't it like 0? And when you're fixing r.
So we're letting the divergence of the unit normal to this, the sphere constant r be 0, right?
Yeah.
So we can rewrite that in terms of the sort of conformal unit normal, right? And then we pick up this extra factor of psi to the 4. And then we can rewrite this as this just going to spherical type coordinates. And then if we write that out, we get this.
So shouldn't that at r equal to big R be 0 when you plug in the solution?
Say again?
If you plug that solution into this equation at r equal to big R,
yeah,
it should be 0, right? I don't think it is.
So we could check, right? Right. And then.
And then the other one has two terms.
So then we have.
Yes, it is. Okay.
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 Should we work out or?
No, it's okay.
Okay.
I'm so confused. Are we solving the very last line over there?
Yeah, we're just check. We, so I mean, you can check that Laplace of this is. A zero, and then you also need to check that at r equals r, it satisfies this, right? So
okay, so that psi is actually the solution to the equation on top, and then at r equal to capital R, it also has to satisfy the other one.
Yeah, so this is the solution through the whole domain, and it needs to satisfy this condition just at the inner boundary. It needs to go to 1 at infinity, which you know, obviously this term goes to 0, so we get 1. And it needs to have, yeah.
And what is that s over there? How did we got that s is equal to r squared? Is it like surface or something? Like the surface area? What is si?
Yeah, so this is just going to point in. So this is just going to point in the radial direction, right?
It's like normal vector?
Yeah, SI is the normal to this ball, right?
Okay.
So it's just pointing, you know, so this ball of constant radius, normal points in the radial direction, right?
I see.
And then, you know, we can use the usual trick here where we can rewrite this way, and we just get the flat metric, right? And then we're just going to and then pick up the side of the 4 when you go to the tilde, and then this is just in the radial direction, so we just get the radial derivative, right?
Yeah.
And then there'll be the extra factors of r just from the determinant of a metric and spherical coordinate. So that's how we get this.
So I have a like the boundaries is here.
Yeah.
And I have the normal vector to that, and I want the covariant derivative of the normal vector to be 0, and what is that again?
Well, this is just kind of the boundary condition I'm specifying to get this non-trivial solution. But you can kind of think of it as this divergence of the unit normal being 0 is equivalent to the mean curvature of the surface being 0. And it turns out that actually corresponds to giving you a black hole.
Mean curvature of the surface be zero? What do we mean by that? Mean curvature.
So remember we talked about how we could, you know, think of this like the extrinsic curvature of this surface is given by the sort of covariant derivative of the unit normal, and then like the mean curvature is the trace of that extrinsic curvature.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
But I thought for a sphere, the mean curvature is always like 1 over r or something.
Right, well, we're getting this extra contribution because like it's only conformally flat, yeah. So yeah, I mean, you could see, for example, what happens if you plug in psi equals 1 here, right?
Oh yeah, true.
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, so it's basically telling you you're not going to get the flat space solution that way, right? Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, so in general, you know, you don't solve these equations by just inspection. Typically, if you're interested in binary black holes or things like that, you would solve them numerically. But yeah, so next, I want to just mention that this is kind of one example of initial data formulation. And there are a number of variations on this, but they sort of all are similar in the sense that you rewrite the Hamiltonian momentum constraints in terms of a scalar and vector type Laplace equation, and you decompose the metric usually into a conformal factor and a conformal piece, and then some variations on how you can decompose the other degrees of freedom. So just to sort of briefly mention a couple others.
Okay, well, sorry, before you move on, in that definition that you wrote there, I think, for detailed, is it the square root of gamma tilde or gamma? Because I thought that you could set like the determinant of gamma tilde to something like 1. But if you want it to be r squared, like this, it would be r4, r to the fourth, then the square root of that would be r squared. I think that's gamma, isn't it?
Sorry, one more.
Should that be square root of gamma in that formula? The rub that's right there, and that in the middle of the board, above detailed, the big detailed.
Here?
Yeah. Is that square root of gamma tilde or gamma?
So I was rewriting this one, right?
Yeah.
So in general, you know, if you have some covariant derivative vector, it's, well, that's the four-dimensional version, right?
Yeah.
But then you can do that for the three-dimensional one or for the...
I'm saying, is it gamma tilde in the square root or gamma, like the conformal version, or just the...
I think it's gamma tilde. Well, when I'm doing this one, it's gamma tilde. If you did it here, then it would be just gamma. So yeah, you could do it this way. You could start with this and write it in terms of gamma tilde. I mean, that's the better way to do it.
S tilde. That's what I don't understand. S also has S tilde.
Because it's the unit normal. So basically, you want this to be 1, right?
Yeah.
So it's going to be...
So it has size squared. Right?
Yeah. So like, if it's the unit normal respect to the flat metric, then you have this extra psi 4 to make the unit normal respect to the conformal metric.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So other formulations of the constraint equations. So another one is the conformal thin sandwich. Or CTS. So in those, your free data is, again, gamma tilde, the trace of the extrinsic curvature. And this one, you specify the conformal lapse as well. And the time derivative of the conformal metric. And then that's your free data, and then your constrained data. Is gonna be the conformal factor and then the shift vector. So again, you can see we still have 4 here and should have 8 here. And then the extended conformal thin sandwich. We have gamma ij, k, and then we have the time derivative of the extrinsic curvature and the time derivative of gamma ij. And so we introduced one new variable so here, and so actually we have to introduce one more constrained variable. So psi, alpha, and beta. And so
K and DTK have different degrees of freedom?
Hmm?
You're saying K and DTK have different degrees of freedom?
I'm saying like the constraint equations don't actually depend on this, right?
Oh.
So if I want to specify what this is, mm-hmm. then basically that's going to give me some extra equation they'll have to solve to get these.
Why are we using all these different formulations?
Right. So the idea is, so we'll talk a little bit about how one might choose the free data next. But yeah, the idea is, in some sense, these are introducing more time derivatives because in a lot of cases we want to sort of, you know, for example, if your system of interest is a quasi-circular binary, then you might imagine you actually have a helical Eulerian vector. So as you go forward in time, you just rotate. So that's your approximate symmetry that you want to try to have your free data enforce. And so in that sort of co-rotating frame, you think that you know that your time derivative should essentially be zero in that co-rotating frame. And so you want to enforce that by using your free data to set those to zero or as close to zero as you can. So that's next. So
we were having similar thing that we were doing before. The only thing is that we're choosing different variables to be free data and like.
So these are sort of different ways to rewrite the Hamiltonian momentum constraints and specifying different degrees of freedom and having slightly different equations. Yeah, so just a couple of quick remarks on choosing the free data. So one simple strategy, I think we mentioned it last time too, would use something like superposition. So, GR is not a linear theory, you can't just superpose two solutions, get a solution. But we might think that if we sort of start our binary, for example, sufficiently far away, then we might be able to superpose two solutions, and then we'll get some correction, which we'll solve for by solving for constrained data, and it won't be sort of too big to take us far away from the physical solution of interest. So we, for example, can choose all this free data by just essentially adding solutions from isolated solutions that we know for black holes or stars. For example, for the conformal metric, you could just take, a neutron star solution, add it to a black hole, a boosted black hole solution some other distance away, and then subtract out flat space. And then use that to set your free data. You can do that and similar things for the other free data quantities. And then, in the limit that these are sort of objects are infinitely far apart, then you expect the conformal factor to go to 1. And if they're not too close together, then it won't be too different from 1. The other thing we just mentioned is if you think that your system of interest has some approximate symmetry, so for example, this helical symmetry for a quasi-circular merger, then you can use that. So, the helical Eulerian vector would say, as you move forward in time, you just rotate by some specified orbital velocity, and then what you want to do is say that the lead derivative, respect to this helical Killian vector is approximately zero. It's not going to be exactly zero, you know, because, for example, there'll be radiation, there'll be inspiraling. But that's another strategy to sort of set these time derivatives of your metric quantities to be zero in this co-rotating frame. And you know, one last thing we haven't talked about is how you choose the matter quantities. At the simplest level, if you're superposing solutions, you could also superpose the matter for the conformal quantities. Usually you want to go a bit further and impose some equilibrium conditions on the matter itself. Have you all done the solving this TOV star solution yet for that tutorial? No? Okay. So that you'll do that in, I think. Solving for like isolated neutron star solutions.
Yes.
So that's an example. Where you basically impose that you're not only do you have a static solution to the Einstein equations, but also that your fluid is at rest. Mm-hmm. And so that's an example of the matter equilibrium conditions. So whenever people construct this initial data, the problems they usually worry about is you always get some sort of spurious gravitational waves because your solution doesn't exactly satisfy these assumptions that you put in, sometimes called junk radiation. So you get bursts of gravitational radiation as you evolve these forward. Another problem people worry about is, for example, you want to, you expect that for, any binary that's been inspiraling for many, many orbits will be, have essentially zero eccentricity. But if you try to construct initial data at some separation, whatever, 10 or 12 orbits before merger, typically there'll be some small eccentricity, just in part due to this junk radiation and the sort of inexactness of the approximations you made. So a lot of times you'll have to actually, evolve some system, measure its eccentricity, and then try to add a small correction to decrease that. So those are some of the examples people worry about for this initial data problem.
Yeah. Can you briefly repeat why, having the time derivatives of k and gamma for the CPS is like a bad thing? Why do we specify the time derivatives?
So we can go to, I think usually it's so we can go to a co-rotating frame, and then set those to zero in that frame. Because, for example, if we're interested in the quasi-circular binary. I mean, another example might be say you want some solution that's close to a boosted solution. For example, your initial data is this object over here has some velocity, this one has some other velocity, and they're going to collide. If they start sufficiently far apart, you think you could probably superpose them, and then we just superpose the time derivatives of the metric too, because they're boosted solutions, right? Okay. Any other questions about initial data before we move on to dynamical horizons? Yeah, so we've been discussing this week how to go to sort of thinking about GR as a set of as an initial value problem. You specify some data, you evolve forward in time, and so now we need to sort of come up with some notion of black holes that's sort of adapted to that dynamical way of thinking. So let's begin by recalling sort of the definition of an event horizon. and discuss some issues with, you know, defining that in terms when we, don't know our solution, at any given time, or when you sort of think of having a solution at given slices of time. So, an event horizon is defined as the it's the boundary of the causal past of future null infinity. So in sort of notation, sometimes you write it as a black hole is the manifold taking away the future past of sort of the causal past of future null infinity, which is represented by sky plus. And then we call the event horizon the boundary of this. So in our, for example, in our Schwarzschild Penrose diagram, we have sky plus here. So this is future null infinity where all outgoing light rays or gravitational waves would end up. And then we go backwards and trace backwards in time the past of all those light rays. And then the part of the manifold not in there, not covered by that, is the interior of the black hole, and the boundary right here. That's the event horizon. So there are a couple of features of the event horizon. So this is sky plus is future null infinity. This would be the causal past of future null infinity. And this is the part of the manifold not covered by that. So the black hole would be the part of the manifold that's not connected to future null infinity. So that's just some notation. That's equivalent to those words. So, one thing we can see immediately from this definition is to know where the event horizon is, we need to know the whole future history of our space-time, right? Until we get all the way to here, we don't know for sure, what points are going to be inside the horizon or not. And so, we can imagine that if the way we're constructing our solution is, we have some, time slices here, and we're evolving forward in time, we'd like to have some local notion of what a black hole is that we can define here before we go all the way to the future. So the second sort of related fact about this is that people use the word teleological. So the event horizon is teleological, and that just sort of means it anticipates the future. To explain what I mean by that, let's consider the case where you have, let's say, a very thin shell of matter with mass m, and it's just some thin spherical shell, and it's collapsing. So ever thin shell, it's collapsing as a function of time. And at some point, it reaches r is equal to 2m, where r is the aerial radius. And you know, just by Birkhoff's theorem, we know that essentially outside the spherical shell, we'll just have Schwarzschild. Inside, we'll just have flat space. So once it crosses this, we should have a Schwarzschild black hole. And so our conformal diagram is going to look something like this. This is sky plus. And if we trace back our event horizon, it'll look something like this, or this should be where it crosses r equals 2m. But what this means is that you know, if you're considering some time, you know, right here, you're actually, you know, if you're inside here, you're actually already inside the event horizon, and you just don't know it yet. You know, the spherical shell hasn't collapsed yet. You know, you have flat space here. There's, you know, any given radius, light rays can continue to move, you know, outward in the radial direction. It's just that, you know, if you shine an outward light ray here, you know, it'll continue to move outward, but then it'll never make it out to infinity, right? So in that sense, this event horizon, you know, knows the future, and is in some sense, you know, acausal in that sense. You mean why did I make it go like that? Well, just everything is going to a point there. So if you're compactifying, but yeah. So I mean, we can imagine our initial conditions are more like, you know, right here or something, but that would be like the future past or whatever. But yeah, the idea is just you have some shell starting from, it's collapsing. At some point it crosses r equals 2m. But before that, you already have an event horizon. Well, yeah, I mean, like exactly how this will be will just kind of depend on our compactification or something like that. I mean, also, like, this is, you know, going to infinitely far in the past, too. So I don't know, you can imagine whatever, you have some shell that goes, but anyway, we can imagine we start at some time here, if that's simpler, some finite time.
Remind me of what snack is exactly. You have a shell of mass that is collapsing, and then you're inside that shell of mass.
Yeah, so if you're sitting, yeah.
And then you're saying you are in the horizon, but you just don't know it yet?
Yeah. So let's say there's some big shell of matter far away from the Earth. If it's sort of sufficiently big, even if it's really far away, we could be inside an event horizon, right? And the point is that, you know, the point is that you're inside the event horizon because the light rays that you're sending out, they could, you know, initially continue to move outward, but then at some point the shell will continue collapsing inward and they will never make it out to infinity. Yeah.
What will happen if they reach the shell, it will get back and collapse, which is necessary. I didn't catch that.
Yeah, so like, I mean, at this point where the shell is at r equals 2m, right? Then you have like a horizon, right? So the light rays can never get out, right? So they'll never make it to that point.
But what would happen to them? Like, would it be like a mirror that it would reflect from it? Or would you just, I don't know that.
Tangent to it because.
Yeah, so sir, I mean, the last light ray, so I mean, so the event horizon is a null surface, right? So
yeah.
Here, if you shine this light ray, it'll just kind of sit along the horizon forever.
Mm.
The ones here, you know, won't make it.
I see.
Or something like that.
At that point, like, the only line over there is r equals to 0, right? On top of the diagram.
This is r equals 0, yeah.
What's that?
Or yeah, well, I mean, they're both. Yeah, so this is the singularity. Yeah, that would form once the matter
r equals to 0.
Completely collapses, yeah. Okay, so sort of to address these, to come up with a different notion of a black hole horizon that we can define just at a given time, just using quantities defined on that time surface, we're going to introduce the notion of apparent horizon. But I think we're pretty much out of time already, so maybe. Should save that for next time. But yeah, basically, next class we'll begin by introducing apparent horizon and defining it solely in terms of things on a specific time slice. And then we'll discuss how this apparent horizon relates to the event horizon. Any questions?